Hi, I'm Paul Havershood, host of The Cost of Living. It's a show about money and how it shapes our lives. In big ways, like why inflation could get worse if we all make more money.
Here's the hard truth in all of this. Workers are going to have to eat that real wage loss.
And small ways, like what's the fastest way to order fast food?
That first Big Mac that comes out of the kitchen is going to the drive-thru.
Check out The Cost of Living. We're on CBC Listen or wherever you get podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight.
Crossing a line, Canada's Auditor General says government officials ignored their own rules, even as the budget for the ArriveCan border app ballooned.
The 11th hour, more than a million displaced Palestinians are now packed inside Rafah, and Israel is threatening a ground invasion. Our guest says this is the world's last chance to stop the bloodshed.
Bully pulpit. At a rally, Donald Trump says Russia is welcome to attack any NATO member that doesn't pony up its full dues. An invitation one German politician tells us sounds a lot like mafia tactics.
Not enough fish in the sea, apparently. Did a stingray at an aquarium in North Carolina become pregnant by a shark in a Romeo and Juliet scenario? Or did it impregnate itself in a Juliet and Juliet scenario?
Oh dear, oh dear. A new roof for Montreal's Olympic Stadium could run more than $800 million, but tearing it down will cost a whole lot more. A local economist says it is time to say au revoir to the big O.
And a mysterious package of mysterious packages. A gallery owner declares a penis amnesty after a statue is repeatedly vandalized by castration, and somehow things get weirder when he receives a box of six clay phalluses. As it happens, the Monday edition, radio that gives you the willies. Canada's Auditor General has added her name to the list of Canadians who have a bone to pick with the ArriveCan travel app. The Canada Border Services Agency tool was supposed to keep things moving at the border in the face of pandemic-era health hurdles, but instead of reducing headaches, it became one for many travelers. And in a report released today, Auditor General Karen Hogan told Parliament that the officials responsible for outsourcing the development of the app showed what she called a, quote, glaring disregard for the basic rules of procurement. We reached Auditor General Karen Hogan in Ottawa.
Auditor General Hogan, you've said that you are deeply concerned by what this audit did not find. What were you looking for that wasn't there in front of you?
I was looking to see that public servants would have documented well during the pandemic decisions that were made around the ArriveCan application so that they could demonstrate due diligence and prudent use of public funds as they developed and implemented this application.
You've gone even further and said that government officials showed a, quote, glaring disregard, end quote, for the rules while developing the ArriveCan app. Just tell us a little bit more about what you mean by glaring disregard.
Well, and you're right, I did find a glaring disregard for what I would say are some of the most basic financial and project management and contracting practices. I would have expected that when a project is launched, that someone sets out an end game, a goal, and that a budget is put into place. It's really hard to manage something against your budget when there isn't a budget established. And that's what we found here, is that neither the Canada Border Services Agency nor the Public Health Agency of Canada had really laid out some of those foundational elements you would see in the management of a project. And then when you turn to procurement practices that we looked at, there's a lot of rules and regulations in the government, federal government, that tell you what you should do, even when it is a non-competitive process in addition to a competitive process. And we were just not seeing some of those key decisions about who made the decision to choose which vendor and why that was the right vendor to choose. And then when we looked at the invoices, we didn't see who carried out the work or what it related to. There were many IT projects on the way at the Canada Border Services Agency, and folks maintaining the records would have needed that basic information in order to be able to maintain proper and accurate financial records.
Your report also describes government officials receiving invitations to, quote, dinners and other activities, unquote. Can you tell us who was making those invitations and what those activities were?
So we did see some invitations, usually via email, to individuals in the branch that were that was responsible for developing and implementing the ArriveCan application. Those invitations came from a few vendors, not just one, but a few vendors, mm-hmm. to several people. We have no documentation to know whether folks attended those events or they didn't, but what I was concerned about is the agency has a code of conduct, and that code of conduct requires that a public servant inform their supervisor if they receive an invitation to a private function from a vendor. That disclosure is needed so that the supervisor can then decide if measures need to be put into place, because this increases the risk that there is real or perceived conflict of interest or bias in making procurement decisions. But here again was one instance where we found that there was important documentation just missing. If individuals informed their supervisors, none of it was documented, and we were unable to show whether or not appropriate measures had been put in place to mitigate the risk.
The CBSA responded to your report by saying it was, quote, working as quickly as possible to replace a paper process that was not meeting public health needs and was also impacting the border, end quote. This was, of course, the height of the pandemic, and you've heard that people needed to move quickly. But at this point, is it sounding to you like it was the pandemic? Is the dog ate my homework here?
Well, I do want to point out that we did two reports in 2021 related to measures at the border. And in the second, we actually found that the ArriveCan application improved the quality of the information that the government was collecting from travelers entering into the country. And it also improved the timeliness of the ability for the government to follow up with travelers. So, for example, when it was paper-based, sometimes it would take the Public Health Agency of Canada almost 28 days before they received contact information from a traveler. Really hard to make sure that they properly quarantine for 14 days when you've received it well after the quarantine period. So there was definitely some value, and it improved the service to Canadians and the ability to track border measures. But the need to be quick and effective doesn't eliminate the need to show accountability and transparency to Canadians. And that's what I would have expected. I don't think every decision or every step along the way needed to be supported and documented, but some of the really key ones should have been done. An emergency is not an excuse to ignore the most basic requirements of maintaining complete and accurate records for transparency and accountability.
And we should mention the CBSA is investigating RCMP. There's an investigation underway as well around all of this and the procurement. Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre is responding to your report today and promising if he was in charge to reverse what he says is the Trudeau government's, quote, doubling of outsourcing. You mentioned procurement a moment ago, but outsourcing in particular, how much was that a part of the problems you found?
So we found that the agencies, the Public Health Agency, as well as the Canada Border Service Agency, had identified early on that they just didn't have the skills or the capacity at the start of the pandemic to develop this app. So it's very reasonable that the public service would turn to a third party to help them develop it. What I would have expected, however, as time went on, we're going into a few years, that dependency and reliance on an external resource would have been reduced for a few reasons. One is it's important to transition some of the knowledge and work into the public service, but also reducing that dependency on a third party would have provided better value for money. And in this case, we did not see that happening.
Auditor General Hogan, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Karen Hogan is the Auditor General of Canada. We reached her in Ottawa. There is nowhere left for civilians in Gaza to go. More than 1.4 million Palestinians are now crammed into Rafah, the last remaining city that has not been emptied out by Israel's bombardment. That's more than five times the community's usual population. That alone is a recipe for humanitarian disaster. But as you've heard, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is threatening a ground invasion of the city. Already today, Israeli airstrikes reportedly killed at least 67 Palestinians during a joint IDF-Shin Bet operation to rescue two Israeli hostages. Hamas is claiming that three other hostages died of injuries sustained in those strikes. Meanwhile, the few aid organizations that are still operational say the prospect of a full-blown military operation in the city is unthinkable. Shayna Lowe is with the Norwegian Refugee Council. We reached her in Jerusalem.
Shayna, is an assault on Rafah imminent or is it already underway?
You know, we really don't know at this time how serious the Israeli operation on Rafah will be. Mm-hmm. It seems like after last night, things have calmed down a bit. But one thing that we've seen throughout the last 4 months of this escalation is that it never has been a safe area. We've had colleagues at NRC who sought shelter in Rafah in October, who were bombed in their house and lost multiple members of their family. So it's really not a matter of if Rafah will be attacked, but how severely. And that is still to be told.
The NRC, the Norwegian Refugee Council, said that a ground invasion could bring what's left of the humanitarian aid apparatus in Gaza, quote, to a halt, end quote. So how are you even functioning, your teams there right now, given what you've just described?
Well, over the last month or so, we were actually able to scale up our operations in Rafah, working as best as we can to support around a dozen sites hosting about 30,000 people. But in order for us to do that and to continue to do that and to continue to scale up our operations, we need a few things. First is assurances that our staff is safe. And on top of that, all of the aid and assistance that's coming in to Gaza right now is coming in through Rafah, either through the Rafah crossing from Egypt or through the Kerem Shalom crossing into Israel. And so if hostilities were to intensify, if Israel were, as they've said that they plan to do, expand their ground operation into Rafah, it would most likely put a halt to our operations because we wouldn't be getting in the aid that we need mm-hmm. to distribute, and we wouldn't be able to send our staff out to do their jobs.
While you were scaling up and doing all the work you discussed there, the NRC also completed an assessment of 9 shelters. Those shelters are housing more than 27,000 civilians in Rafah. What did you find?
We found that the conditions that displaced people were living in were just simply unimaginable. Hundreds of people sharing a single toilet. Most of the facilities did not have any showers, lack of access to clean water. And we identified a number of diseases in all of these sites, everything from lice to hepatitis A, respiratory illness, intestinal flu, spread of all sorts of diseases that you can imagine would be prevalent in places where there's little sanitation and people living in incredibly close quarters.
One of your colleagues, Youssef Hamash, who is in Rafah, spoke with our CBC Radio colleague Brent Bambury over the weekend. We're going to play you and our listeners a little bit of that conversation now.
Yeah, unfortunately, we ran out of options. There is no more options for us to take. We are trapped here in Rafah. We cannot move from Rafah to any different location. So literally, we are trapped between the Egyptian border, Israeli tanks.
It's been so hard to establish communication with teams there. Our producers have certainly been trying, and we speak to folks when we can. What else are you hearing from your colleagues specifically today?
You know, I checked in with Youssef first thing this morning, and first of all, he had no internet at the location where he was sleeping. So he got up as he would any other day and went to our office, and that's where he was first notified that we had requested that our staff not move at all today because of the bombardments in Rafah last night. But what he told me about last night was that he just simply didn't sleep. The bombardments were everywhere. It was incredibly loud. It was incredibly scary. And knowing that Benjamin Netanyahu has already stated that he plans to expand the operations into Rafah for Palestinians in Gaza, they thought that the bombardments last night were the start of that expanded operation, and they were petrified because, as Yusuf says so eloquently, they are trapped. And Yusuf said, I heard Yusuf say earlier today that basically they feel like if this operation were to expand, then really the only choice that people have is how they would choose to die.
Yeah, I've heard people say that the dead are more fortunate than us in some cases. And what you just said and what they've said is difficult to hear. The British Foreign Secretary, you may have heard, David Cameron, says his government is concerned about the situation in Rafah and wants Israel to, quote, think very seriously before it takes any further action, end quote. Joe Biden says Israel must not expand its military operations in Rafah without, quote, a credible and executable plan for ensuring the safety of more than 1 million people sheltering there, unquote. The EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, had some strong words in response.
If you believe that too many people are being killed, maybe you should provide less arms in order to prevent so many people being killed. It's not logical.
Do you think a ground invasion in Rafah might compel countries like the United States to listen to what Borrell is saying there?
I mean, who would have thought that we would have gotten to the point where we have 28,000 Palestinians dead in 4 months? And so I'm really not sure what it will take in order for countries to do more to prevent just unbelievable civilian loss. What we have seen is just simply unimaginable. And while it is heartening to see that there are shifts in rhetoric that are happening far too late, I think Borrell is right that we need to see arms transfers to Israel be restricted. And really, it's not just about the Israeli assaults, but it's also on the conscience of the countries that are supplying Israel with these weapons that are causing such tremendous death and devastation and destruction throughout Gaza.
Shayna, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Shayna Lowe is a spokesperson with the Norwegian Refugee Council. We reached her in Jerusalem. The stadium has about 20,000 little holes in its Teflon roof. Anytime there's a possibility of 3 centimeters of snow, it's shut down. Obviously, that would not be an issue in Maui or Mexico City, but in Montreal, it's a problem. So up to half the year, the city's Olympic Stadium just sits there, conspicuously out of commission, but never out of sight. And now the landmark has a new lease on life. Last week, the province announced that it had hired construction firms to build it a new, non-retractable, all-weather roof. The price tag is $870 million, and it will take 4 years. But tearing it down, they say, would cost $2 billion. Moshe Lander is a professor of economics at Concordia University. We reached Mr. Lander in Montreal.
Moshe, Montreal's mayor, Valérie Plante, said last week, you may have heard, quote, whether you say you love it or hate it, the Olympic Stadium has become a symbol of Montreal, unquote. What does it symbolize to you?
It's a symbol of everything that's wrong with Montreal. It plays exactly to the stereotype that Canada has about Montreal and Quebec. It's cost overruns, it's inefficiency, it's corruption, it's wasted government money. It's an eyesore.
But maybe a makeover would help that. It's still a piece of history.
Yeah, it's an expensive piece of history. You know, to spend $870 million, assuming that the budgeted number is correct, makes it sound like it's the very first renovation that's been put into that stadium that stadium has been broken almost since it opened, and the roof has never worked in the way that it was supposed to. To try and extend its life merely on the idea that it's some part of the skyline, really, really expensive, especially when you don't have anybody lined up that's going to use it.
The Minister of Tourism, Caroline Proux, said this stadium could attract Beyonce, Bruce Springsteen, Taylor Swift. They didn't come to Montreal on their last tours. So they're in the camp, or she's in the camp of, if you build it, they will come. Why not turn it into an enticing concert venue?
Well, you know, you can put a roof on the place, but the inside still is not acoustically fit for those types of concert acts. The 21st century concert is not the same as the 20th century concert that I remember. You know, the inside still needs to be massively renovated. It's still almost in the same shape as it was when the Montreal Expos played there, and that's now almost 20 years ago. The seats are not designed for the modern experience. The floor is cement. The design of the bowl is part of the cigarette ashtray design that existed in St. Louis, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia 50 years ago, and all of those buildings have been knocked down because they're well past their prime, and they were all replaced with something that's more 21st century acoustically designed to attract the Beyoncés, the Taylor Swifts, the Drakes, and the Bruce Springsteens. So it's not even fixed once they address the root.
What about something that acoustics aren't necessary for, spaces, sports? Any chance that this could be a hot ticket sports venue?
No, it wasn't a hot ticket sports venue when the Expos left town. And that's part of the reason why they left town. It was such a terrible stadium. You know, to play in 50, 60,000 seats, it's not meant for hockey. If somehow, against hope, basketball comes to Montreal, they would play at the Bell Centre, which is where the Canadiens play. And if that arena reaches the end of its life in the next 15 to 20 years, they're going to move to something that seats 18 to 20,000, not 50 or 60. That leaves then the NFL, which would not expand into Montreal, or the CFL, which could not fill up that stadium, or soccer, which has a dedicated facility that's already in its existence right now.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Moshe, but I don't think you like the stadium.
You are not wrong. I don't like the stadium. But, you know, I'm skeptical of a lot of stadiums when you put public funds into them, because they're often used to justify large amounts of taxpayer money and the promise that somehow, you said it, if you build it, they will come. And unfortunately, they don't come. And what they leave behind is a legacy of large costs. And so it just seems that you're trying to protect some sort of political legacy rather than building it on sound economics.
Tearing this down, the minister says, is going to be even more costly, $2 billion, because of the fact that it's on top of a metro station, the type of build it was originally.
Yeah, I mean, you want to say that it's $2 billion. I could tell you it's $1 billion, might be $5 billion. The problem is that let's say it's $2 billion, and I believe that that's massively overstated. Somebody deserves to be sued for that. How could you build a stadium that now cannot be destroyed because of the prohibitive cost that would be involved? That would seem like utter negligence at the time that it was constructed. And so whether that's the city, the province, the builders, whoever it was, somebody deserves a big lawsuit for now basically causing a huge amount of taxpayer money to go into renovating that place with no known tenant, with no known concert dates, with no known ideas to how it's going to be utilized, merely on the grounds of it's just too expensive to destroy. It just seems like it's a major, major problem. But the reality is that if you can build a stadium these days from scratch for $1 billion, $1.5 billion, I can't imagine that it's $2 billion to destroy what's already there. It's empty. Nobody's using it. And if you can take $870 million to take the roof off and put a new roof on, are you really going to tell me that it's about $1.5 billion to destroy the actual bowl itself? You could probably take it apart in bits and pieces that wouldn't disrupt the metro line underneath, and it still wouldn't cost $2 billion. It almost seems like what they're doing is trying to throw a number out there that scares people into saying, oh, well, I guess $870 million spent is better than $2 billion spent.
So if you had your way, if they took your advice, what do you want the government to do with this site?
Well, I totally agree that they should take the roof off, but once the roof is off, I'd also take a wrecking ball right through the middle of that open roof, and I'd smash out the sides as well. That thing needs to go. So why not put up social housing? Every city in Canada is talking about housing shortages and the problems of affordable housing. So why not use it to try and alleviate some of the social problems, even if you have to spend a couple billion dollars? The fact that it would lead to thousands of families that could live in that space for decades to come seems a lot better than Taylor Swift.
Moshe, thank you.
Anytime.
Moshe Lander is a professor of economics at Concordia University. We reached him in Montreal. Donald Trump is not known for subtlety, so his message to America's NATO allies was characteristically blunt: start paying up or else. Here's what he said at a weekend rally in his bid to recapture the White House, recounting a conversation he says took place at a 2018 NATO summit when he was president.
They asked me that question. One of the presidents of a big country stood up and said, "Well, sir, if we don't pay and we're attacked by Russia, will you protect us?" I said, "You didn't pay? You're delinquent?" He said, "Yes, let's say that happened. No, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the hell they want. You got to pay. You got to pay your bills."
Those remarks are still reverberating today in Europe, in Canada, and in Washington. Here's Mr. Trump's rival for the Republican nomination, former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley, speaking about the threat posed by Russian President Vladimir Putin.
"Keep in mind that this is a man who has wanted to destroy America and defeat America for years. I dealt with Russia every single day. It is a mistake for Trump to side with Putin over our allies. We needed a lot of friends after 9/11. We better remember that."
Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley speaking earlier today with Bloomberg News. German MEP Sergei Lagodinsky is in Brussels. That's where we reached him.
Sergei, when you heard those words, "do whatever they want," from the former U.S. President Donald Trump, what was your gut reaction?
Well, this was the actual piece that really angered me and surprised me, in the sense because this was really reckless and this is really kind of a mafia type talk. So Trump can still surprise us.
When you say mafia type talk, elaborate.
Well, we're used to Trump speaking in transactional terms. So the first part of what he said, you know, "if you don't pay, we do not protect you," that's very transactional. That shows that, no values, no solidarity, no strategic outlook is there. It's just pure transactionalism. But the other part, you know, goes beyond it. It's kind of almost a sadistic way of forcing, you know, someone who is dependent on you to pay kind of a ransom. And if not, encouraging the attacker to actually show what it is worth to pay or not to pay. And this is something that is really kind of a prison type, mafia type way of dealing with your, you know, companions or partners.
And it sounds like you believe that this is more than just the kind of talk that people are used to hearing from Trump. Bluster, and certainly not diplomatic, but deeper than that.
Well, we're used to this stream of consciousness, you know, when he speaks. But boy, what a conscious, you know, it's like, what a mindset. And this is something which is, of course, worrisome, especially now following the interview by Putin and an interview done by a friend, basically, of Trump, basically signaling towards Kremlin, you know, "you're free to try it out. We can leave it ambivalent." You know, he's not saying he's not going to protect, you know, he's saying it's conditioned. And that already in itself is basically a breach of any reliability of a guarantee, of a security guarantee, on which so far the NATO a mutual promise was built on. And this is worse.
If Russian President Vladimir Putin were to take this as an opening to encroach on NATO territory. What do you think that might look like? What countries do you think should be worried?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen fast, but this is definitely kind of an invitation into the future. You know, first of all, we're seeing that the administration, if upcoming change of power in the White House, it's the transition is still going to take a year at least. And then, you know, there are still structures both within the establishment in the United States and within NATO that can contain, you know, fast changes. But this erosion of this mutual promise of NATO is something that is already signaled now. And especially for us here in Brussels, where we see how long it would take for us, if at all, to be able to substitute the American capabilities by our own, that's a long-term project. And that, of course, causes a lot of unease here on this side of the ocean.
Republicans, senior Republicans, in fact, have said they're not worried. Senator Tom Cotton said countries like Germany, although I recognize that Germany has increased its defense spending recently, Senator Cotton says countries like yours do not spend enough on defense, and Trump is simply, as he put it, ringing the warning bell. How do you respond?
Well, there are smart ways to ring the warning bell, and there are ways that are absolutely stupid. You know, you don't ring a bell if you're talking openly and you are projecting to the whole world your fantasies, you know, basically inviting the aggressor to go on with aggression. So I understand what Senator Cotton is saying. This is something that many of us have been saying. And to be honest, most European countries do have a rethinking moment, but it is not easy to transform our economies, our armies in an instantaneous way. It's also a lot about coordination, and it's also a lot about capabilities that are not easy to substitute. If we're talking about nuclear capabilities, it's not an easy task, because it's not just having a couple of, you know, nuclear missiles. It's a whole system which should be safe, secure, and reliable. And it is not possible to substitute it in 5 years or 2 years.
There's a significant meeting, a NATO meeting on Thursday. What do you want to hear and see come out of that meeting?
I think it's important that NATO is sending a signal that we stay together, and we stay together collectively. There is a lot of talk within NATO now, for example, about the future of our Ukraine aid and whether NATO should be the organization that will take over from the American leadership in providing capabilities to Ukraine. Ukraine is the test case for the solidarity transatlantically and within the NATO in general, and also projecting towards the other side that we are serious about restructuring our capabilities, about our decision-making systems as well, but also on providing a very clear message of solidarity towards countries like the Baltic states or Poland, who are in the epicenter of Putin's fantasies, and they are not out of reach.
Sergei, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Sergei Lagodinsky is a Green Party member of European Parliament. He's in Brussels.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart. And for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
In the British town of Grimsby, a statue once stood tall and proud, a statue of the town founder, whose name was Grimm, with a baby on his shoulders, both of them nude. And there the statue continued to stand until it was moved into storage in 2006, slightly less tall and proud, after years of being vandalized in a number of different, creative and, frankly, traumatic ways. The most creative and traumatic being the repeated removal of the statue's various exposed body parts, one of which you have correctly guessed. The whereabouts of any of these pilfered appendages have remained a town mystery for years, until a package from an unknown sender arrived at the doorstep of a local gallery, creating another mystery. Dale Wells is an artist and the owner of the Turntable Gallery. We reached him in Cleethorpes, England.
Dale, what did you find when you opened up this mystery package?
Yeah, so we had a bit of an unusual one, and we found a box. It was just a brown paper wrap box, a bit of writing on it. And upon opening it, we had this shoebox. Inside the shoebox, there was a cookie tin. Inside the cookie tin, so it's a bit like a Russian doll, inside the cookie tin, there was straw with a note and six penises. And also looks like the workings of a gland as well. So I don't know if there was
an
option in different, the end of the penis. So okay. It looked like they were kind of going through various options for the look.
Right. And is horrified the right word or am I projecting?
No, I think you're projecting. It's
you were like totally fine. What a nice surprise!
You know what? We are in almost one of the weirdest counties in the country. And
if you weren't before, this will cement that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. it's unsurprisingly kind of work a day, to be honest, for us. But we'd been involved with it so long that it almost felt like there was a magnet kind of drawing these penises and a tin towards us.
What did that note say?
Right. Well, to sort of paraphrase it, it said something like, I've just been clearing through my granddad's possessions. And I think these are what you were looking for. Been following the story closely. So it's obviously somebody that has seen our stories. I don't know if you've read, but we had a penis amnesty last year because it was that part that the statue that we were restoring had lost several times. And we'd said, it'd be great to maybe find one of these that were, lying as relics in somebody's house. And instead of one, they delivered six.
So the statue at the center of this mystery, just to let our listeners in, is the statue of your town's founder. It's in storage right now. And as our listeners just heard Chris mention, it's constantly missing appendages and body parts. So it's in storage right now, right?
It is, yeah. So it's in a bit of a sort of shabby state. It's been kicked about so many times. Like you said, it has missed its phallus. Well, I mean, there must be three, four, five of them around the town somewhere. But it's lost, the back of its head. It's missing the foot, hands, etc.
Why
there's all sorts
are people
of parts
doing this?
Gone. I think it sounds like a bit of a silly way of putting it, but almost it's the townspeople taking it into their ownership in a lot of ways. If you can, I don't know, break its willy off and keep it in your drawer or something. It's a part of that founder's statue that is with you forever.
But it to be clear, the gifts that you received from that mystery sender, you don't think they belong to the statue.
In some ways, I mean, I'm guessing that if this person has followed the story, then they must know, that their grandparent was maybe a sculptor or an apprentice sculptor or somebody who helped in it. Otherwise, I don't know how you would get the link, to be honest. So I think there might be some kind of original penis sort of story in there, but I don't think they're the ones that were broken off it. I think they were maybe maquettes or, workups to maybe cast off.
I see. You and your partner are working on making a new statue to replace the old one, right? So are you going to integrate one or more
you know
of these
what?
Pieces?
I think we need an absolute halo of them around, don't we? We need a ton
of them. I don't know.
I don't know
if I would say yes to that, but it's your town.
Well, it is. Yeah, myself and Darren Neve, who I co-own the Turntable Gallery with, we are working with our local college to bring a statue back to the plinth from which Grimm was taken. So we're kind of working with the students. We want them to create something which they actually want to see.
Is the measure of success for you and the team then to have people continue to break off its parts, or would success be it stays as is for eternity?
Well, we either make something that is, you know, pretty much impervious, and maybe it harms people by taking it off. It could run like an electric current through it. I mean, I don't know what the I don't know what the health and safety regs are around that, but I imagine we probably can't get away with it. But yeah, I think that it'd be great if people still interacted with it. So drawing it or whatever,
yeah,
dress
you can
it
just
up,
take then, a selfie, like you don't.
We can do, exactly. Yeah, it's a lot less interventionist, isn't it?
If the mystery sender happens to be listening, yeah, which I'm sure they are, what would you want to say to them?
You know what? I think that they should probably stop sending unsolicited boxes of penises to people. It's quite inhospitable. It'd be great to meet them, to be honest. It'd be lovely to see what the actual story is and the circumstances. I mean, for them, you kind of think it probably kind of mortifying knowing that your granddad had kept this cookie tin full of penises around the house.
Dale, thank you.
No worries. Thank you ever so much.
Dale Wells is an artist and the owner of the Turntable Gallery in Grimsby. We reached him in Cleethorpes, England. Prosthetics have come a long way, whether we're talking about cosmetics, cost, or comfort. But even the most sophisticated artificial limbs still have their limitations, and a new device aims to address one of the big ones. It was developed by researchers in Italy and Switzerland. It's called the Mini Touch. Paired with an ordinary prosthetic hand, it's a step toward restoring a full range of senses to people with amputations, starting with temperature. Francesco Ibarrite is the co-author of a new study on that device, which is still in the experimental stage. We reached him in Pisa, Italy.
Francesco, what does the Mini Touch look like?
The Mini Touch looks like a small box that the moment we put in on top of a prosthesis. Obviously, we plan to have that completely integrated into the shape and the structure of the socket of the prosthesis. So together with that we can see as the brain of the system, we have a small piece of metal that we call a thermal display that is placed directly in contact with the skin. That is the device that changes its own temperature to deliver this information to the
that
subject.
That goes right on the fingertip?
And obviously, no. Oh, so the display is on the residual limb, and the sensor is on the fingertip of the prosthesis. So the temperature that is read by the sensor is provided to the user with the thermal display on the skin of the user. Our discovery of the last year proved how we can use some specific locations of the skin to project the thermal sensation directly on the phantom hand. Thanks to this, we can evoke thermal sensations on the phantom hand of the subject. Obviously, from the perspective of the subject, then that means that they touch with a finger an object, and the same finger of the phantom hand feels the sensation.
Your subject, Fabrizio, the participant, how did Fabrizio react?
So Fabrizio was very surprised every time he was able to feel a sensation that usually are very subtle and also hard to describe. So for example, when he was touching my skin, while we were shaking our hands or in general during the experiments, I was surprised for him because he wasn't used to feel that on the phantom hand. Obviously, he's familiar with the sensation because he has the other hand, but feeling that on the hand that is still missing is for him a very strong sensation, because it gives him the person, the human connection. And that's a lot about this new prosthesis is about.
You mentioned that this is an external device right now. Ultimately, you and your team want to create an artificial limb or a prosthetic that incorporates this technology that you've put together. Can you imagine a time in the near future where that is widely available to patients?
So we expect to be able to deliver this technology to the market in the next years. Right now, the most important thing we need to do is to clinically validate the effects, the long-term effects of using such a prosthesis. Because clearly during the short time we had available for our experiments, we were able to measure some improvements in the way in which the subject was using his prosthesis. But we expect to have an overall improvement of the quality of life of any subject that is using this prosthesis over time. And to measure these things, to see these things happen, takes time. And also repeating the same experiments with multiple people to prove how widely available how widely usable is this technology for the public. We are pretty happy because the way in which the system works, it doesn't rely on any surgery. So that means that anyone that is interested even to try that can. So that's why we really want to have that ready for the market. But obviously it takes some time and testing before proving how effective it is.
Is there a lineup of people who want to try it out?
So, yeah, I mean, obviously many of the subjects that already tried that ask us to have the device for during their daily life. They cannot wait to do that. It's nice because obviously after these experiments, we keep in contact with our subject usually, because they are very interested and invested into the cause. They feel what they're doing as very important for the others, mostly because for them is mostly a job, because they spend days, hours of their time to help us. But they're extremely proud of what they're doing, because they know that this is helpful, if not for them, for the next generation of people that are using a prosthesis.
And no, you reported no adverse effects for Fabrizio and others.
No adverse effect. Let's say during the experiments, obviously, depending on what type of objects you are manipulating, you may feel he may have felt his phantom limb colder. So there's a very funny moment in which after a long sequence of experiments in which he was asked to manipulate cold object, he asked me if I was so kind to hit a little bit his finger because it was a little bit frozen. And that was a very strong moment, because we realized that for him it wasn't an illusion. It was a real experience. And his finger was cold and he needed a way to heat it up. Mm-hmm. So, but let's say I wouldn't define that as an adverse effect. It's not an adverse effect, and there's no known ways to cause pain or, in general, to have problems during this type of experiments.
I was reading that Fabrizio would love to use this to cook more.
Yes, he's a really passionate cook, and he does that for his own family. And he said, you know, cooking is a moment in which I really miss not being able to feel the temperature, because it let you do things without looking at what you're doing. And that's obviously something that I really miss.
Francesco, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. It was a pleasure to be able to explain a little bit more what we're doing here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
Francesco Ibarrite is a PhD candidate at the Biorobotics Institute of Sant'Anna. We reached him in Pisa, Italy. Bird birch bark scrolls are an important part of Anishinaabe culture. They're used to record histories and tell stories for future generations. So when a collection of birch bark scrolls popped up for sale on an auction site, it got the attention of Whitney Gravel. She's the president of Bay Mills Indian Community in Michigan, and she was willing to get those scrolls back for her people at any cost. We reached Whitney Gravel in Chicago.
Whitney, in the end, how much did it cost you to get these four scrolls back? What was the winning bid?
The winning bid at the end of the auction was $7,500 US, but afterwards, when we began to process payment, we ended up paying a total of $10,500 because there was a buyer's premium, an auction house fee, as well as some sales tax associated with the purchase.
So that's more than $14,000 Canadian, just for our listeners in Canada as well. How do you weigh, you know, that cost out of pocket with the importance of getting these back for you and your community?
You know, when I really began to first approach the auction, I was prepared to spend any amount necessary to make sure that these scrolls were returned back to their communities. They're truly priceless pieces that have a sacred place not only in our history but in our current culture and modern day practices. And you know, I'll throw in there, I didn't want them to be very expensive, sure, but I was prepared to fight for them through any means possible.
And was it a fight? Was there furious bidding?
Yeah, there was. So when we actually entered into the auction, it's done online, mm-hmm, and you're kind of in this anonymous bidding box where you just simply click a button. And prior to the actual auction going live, there was a series of pre-bids that took place. So initially it started at a few dollars, but as folks were entering pre-bids leading up to the auction, the price was already sitting at $4,500 US. Mm-hmm. And so once we actually entered into the auction, the bids would increase by increments of $250 US. And so it would go from $4,500, increase $250, and then with each subsequent bid, it kept going up.
When it was in the heat of it and you saw the bids going up and you said it was getting heated, was it nerve-wracking?
It absolutely was. I participated in the bid process myself, and it was very anxiety-inducing because you're trying to fight and get back something that's extremely precious to you, but it's also you're committing, you know, thousands of dollars towards the purchase itself, and then to have, you know, an individual or multiple individuals fighting you to also get the same item. It was really frightening to be part of that process and, you know, simply wanting to have something that was taken be returned to your community. So I would not want to do it again, but I'm glad we were able to play a small role in making sure that these scrolls were returned home.
And describe what's on them for our listeners.
Yeah, so what we ended up being able to get back is four birch bark scrolls. Two of the scrolls are unidentified, and because the images on the auction site were very low resolution, we weren't able to decipher their teachings or the wisdom that they carry prior to making the purchase. And then two of the scrolls, one was labeled the Migration Story, and the other one was labeled Ghost Lodge. And so once we get the scrolls and return them back to our tribal nation, we'll be able to decipher the teachings and the wisdom contained within.
So it sounds like there are a lot of questions still to be answered that you all have. You haven't seen them in person yet. You haven't been able to authenticate them. In the end, does it matter to you if all of that money was spent and these are not authentic?
No, it doesn't, because, you know, we had that conversation prior to participating in the auction. And we made the determination that even if it turns out the scrolls were not authentic, we wanted to remove them from circulation so that they could not be utilized or, you know, presented in a way where they could take advantage of another tribe in the future. So one of our first steps once we return the scrolls back to our tribal nation is to first verify their authenticity. Once we do that, we are going to gather our elders and experts to then, you know, if they are authentic, decipher the teachings contained within.
Our colleagues at CBC Indigenous learned the auction house was actually contacted by the FBI and was told to go ahead with the sale. But there are U.S. laws that require items that are in museum and institutions to be repatriated to First Nations. Do you believe that there needs to be a shift and that law needs to be extended to auction houses and private collectors as well?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think before we even get into the process of talking about what laws could be implemented to do so, I think there needs to be more training and awareness brought towards private collectors on the types of items that they're holding, as well as the sacredness that they have towards many Indigenous communities, no matter what the item is. You know, for birch bark scrolls in our teachings, they're very much living things. They have a spirit, they contain teachings, and so it's very imperative that they're also taken care of in a certain way.
How are people in Bay Mills feeling?
I think there's a lot of apprehension, you know, first in verifying the authenticity of the scrolls, but also a sense of pride in being part of the story of these scrolls and making sure that they're returned home.
Whitney, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I hope you have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Whitney Gravel is the president of Bay Mills Indian Community. We reached her in Chicago. Thank you. Thank you. Welcome to another shocking episode of How Did This Pregnancy Occur? Charlotte had it all. A reasonably spacious home, a long, venomous tail, a flat body that allowed her to hide in sand to pounce on unsuspecting shrimp, and a thriving career as a stingray in an aquarium in North Carolina. Everything was great. But in September, staff at the Aquarium and Shark Lab by Team Echo noticed that Charlotte was pregnant. She's expecting up to 4 pups, but the identity of the other parent was a mystery. Aquarium staff were faced with shocking possibilities, which shocked them. Was it one of her tank mates, both male white spot bamboo sharks? Okay, settle down. Or was Charlotte the stingray's unknown impregnator a stingray named Charlotte? As in, shockingly, Charlotte herself. Okay. All right, come on, live studio audience. Settle down, I said. Thank you. Now, the executive director of Team Echo, which runs the aquarium, says maybe the stingray and one of the sharks were star-crossed lovers, although there's no evidence that has ever happened on Earth. Or maybe Charlotte became pregnant by parthenogenesis, a rare reproductive strategy in which a female reproduces asexually, which has happened before on Earth. Which could it be? It's the second thing, but the aquarium insists it might not be the second thing, and we should all stay tuned and wait for Charlotte to give birth to unprecedented shark-ray hybrids or little clones of herself. It will be the second things. Whichever you're hoping for, though, good luck. Until those pups are born, Charlotte is a ray of hope. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1, following the world at 6.
You can also listen to the show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.